This is London Calling North America. Next, we present London Column, a radio magazine of extracts from outstanding broadcasts from the BBC in the past week. Stand by for 15 seconds for London Column.
London Column. This is Peter Watson once again presenting a weekly radio digest of items headlined or modest, but all selected for your interest and entertainment from the worldwide services of the BBC. London Column. Today we bring you the voice of an American businesswoman in London, a note on some Highland games held some 400 miles away from their native Scotland, and we join in the unofficial birthday greetings bestowed on Queen Mary. And to this royal occasion, we'll give pride of place in London Column. Royal birthdays are very properly the occasion for salutes of guns, the presenting of greetings from heads of friendly states, and other formalized demonstrations. When the birthday is no less than the 83rd of our most gracious Queen Mother, then the warmth even of formal greetings couldn't have given Queen Mary more personal pleasure than did the spontaneous show of affection by the anonymous crowds who waited for her to drive from her home to Buckingham Palace for a birthday luncheon with King George and Queen Elizabeth. And as the Queen Mother left Buckingham Palace, our reporter Gottfried Talbot had our microphone among the people crowding the roadway and the steps of the Victoria Memorial.
In this crowd in front of Buckingham Palace on this Queen Mary's birthday, this crowd which has gathered to see the guests come away from this royal luncheon party, are people from London, from all over this country, from many parts of the Commonwealth, and as I've just discovered, from America. Because in the crowd, prominent here because of their height and because of their wide-brimmed steps and hats, and indeed their cowboy boots, are two gentlemen who do come from America, and I've got one beside me, pulled out of the crowd, at the microphone now. May we have your name?
Evitts Haley.
Mr. Haley, where do you come from?
I come from Canyon, Texas. And my boy, Evitts Jr., is with me.
Well, how do you do? Welcome to you both. What are you doing in this country, may I ask?
We're here on a visit, seeing great to the United Kingdom, Great Britain generally.
Now, you're a cowboy. I rather suspect you're rather more than a cowboy. You're probably a rancher, aren't you, a farmer?
Yes, sir. I own my own ranch in Texas.
Have you been looking at any cattle here?
Yes, both in Scotland and in England. The herds of Herefords and Aberdeen Angus and Shorthorn cattle on these islands.
And what has brought you here in front of Buckingham Palace on this day in the crowd?
We heard that Queen Mary was to appear, and we came hoping we'd have an opportunity of seeing her.
And have you?
We have. Well, we have no queen in Texas. We have a great regard for the qualities that the Queen Mary exemplifies, and especially her stability and her great courage and her character in these troubled times. And we'd like to be here, glad to be here, to pay our humble tribute to the character of the Queen.
Well, you've seen her go away, and I hope you've been impressed and you've enjoyed with what you've seen of London and of the royal family this morning.
We have, and we're tremendously impressed by the demonstration of affection of the British people for the Queen in her passing here this brief moment.
Well, thank you, Mr. Haley, and you too, Mr. Haley, Jr. We hope you have a very successful and profitable visit to this country.
And we have another American visitor with us, Miss Dorcas Campbell. She's long been a lecturer to women's groups in the United States on the management of money and the vital part that women play in maintaining the prosperity of a nation. Miss Campbell is an officer of a leading New York bank, and now she's on a lecture tour in Britain under the auspices of the Winifred Cullis Foundation. We asked her to explain its purpose to an inquiring British woman, Sheila Stewart.
What is in general the subject of your lectures over here? Women and their money, which means really money management, how to husband what they have and what they're making.
Yeah, exactly what do you mean by that, to the ignorant like me?
Well, there's no standard pattern that you can give anyone for a management of money, but we do make a slight recommendation, such as the need for everybody to have at least 6 months' salary in a bank that they can get out very quickly in case of emergency or unemployment. Next, we like to tell women that they need to have insurance for the benefit of their estate and to protect them. Then they need to have savings bonds, and that means something similar to your national savings movement bonds. And then beyond that, if women still have enough money to go on, we want them to buy stocks and bonds, because that really keeps our industry going. And behind industry is employment, and behind employment is happiness, and behind that is our free enterprise system, which we love and want to go on.
I think that's an admirable idea.
Women do need to understand money management, because there are more women making money. Women are living longer. They're living longer than their husbands, too. They're inheriting more money. And they must learn something about money management. If I can help at any time in any way, I want to do so.
Miss Campbell, what made you go into banking originally?
Well, I suppose you might say it was an accident. I'd once worked for a social agency, and the president of that agency was also a president of the bank. When I decided that I no longer wanted to be in social work, he invited me to go to the bank to work.
I see. And is it a very unusual career in America?
No, it's rather usual. There's 6,000 women officers in the United States out of 60,000 officers in banks, and I should say there are 120,000 to 150,000 women in banks.
Really? Do you think it's an important career for women? Do you think more women should go in for it?
I think it's very valuable for a woman, whether she's going to be married later, whether she's going to continue in business for someone else, or whether she's going to be in business for herself, to learn about the handling of money.
Well, I do hope you will have a great success, and if I may say so, you don't look at all like what I imagined a woman banker would look like.
What did you think I would be?
Rather fiercer and stiffer, and you look so charming and so good-looking.
Oh, merci.
Anyway, thank you very much for coming along, Miss Campbell.
Thank you.
And we're still on the subject of visitors to London, but this time from Scotland. It's a remarkable thing about the Scots that wherever there's even a handful of them, in Lagos or Labrador or Louisville or London, they set up a Caledonian Association in less time than it takes to save Robert Burns. Only in the case of London, there isn't just a handful, but fully 500,000 Scots. They're often joined from time to time by invading British clansmen who come south to cheer on some Scots international football team. But no such invasion compares with last week's, when the clans came to the White City Stadium for what our Scots reporter Tom Masson calls the London Caledonian Games.
There were tens of thousands of them, many from the wee crofts and the glens of the far north, from the farms of the lowlands, from the towns and the villages. And these were real Scots, most of them wearing the kilt, many carrying bagpipes, and some with skean doos, the little dagger carried in the stocking. The weather couldn't have been better for any outdoor event. Bright and sunny, with just enough breeze to keep the yellow Scottish standard and the blue St. Andrew's flags fluttering from alternate flagpoles all round the high walls of the stadium and from the grandstands. The impressive opening ceremony began with a solitary piper walking into the centre of the vast arena and playing a pibroch, to be followed later by the game's flag, guarded by six brawny Scots carrying claymores, those ancient two-edged Scottish broadswords. From then, until Auld Lang Syne was sung and the last notes of the national anthem had died away at the end, this was a real Scots Highland gathering, such as I had only seen before at a Boyne, Cow, or Royal Braemar. From where I was sitting, high up in the press box, it was a delightful experience to watch the moving pattern of colour against the dazzling green grass in the centre of the arena. Here, the dancers' toes twinkled over the swords in the traditional sword dance. There, a flash of white as an athlete sped round the track, jumped or pole vaulted, and beyond the dancers, great muscular Scots, kilted and stripped to the waist, throwing the hammer or putting the weight. In the centre of it all, pipe bands coming and going as they competed for a large silver trophy. And for a while at the back of my picture, on the far side of the arena, a long streak of yellow and white as two tug-of-war teams lay close to the ground, their heels dug in, straining every muscle in their particular feat of strength. Crossing the Cabo was the event that attracted most attention from everyone, and no wonder. Those great things are 20 feet long and weigh nearly 200 weights. The particular ones used in these games were larch trees and came from Kakubrisha. Towards the end of the day, the arena was cleared, some sheep herded on, and then a shepherd from Peeblesshire entered with his four champion sheepdogs, and they proceeded to make the sheep go through gates and into pens. Those black and white collies streaked up and down the arena, or edged forward inch by inch, or sometimes lay motionless as a stone, watching every signal of their master and obeying his strange whistles. whistles which rather reminded one of the wind rushing through the whins and the bracken on a Scottish hillside. It was a grand day, and one felt that one had really been to Scotland, and not just on a sixpenny underground journey from Piccadilly.
One more Scot to come, London columnist Alan Melville, with one more item of important news in Britain. Alan Melville.
This is Alan Melville speaking. A French horse called Galcador has naturally won the Derby. An American golfer called Crosby has naturally failed to win our amateur golf championship, leaving as National Hero of the Week Mr. Noel Baker, Minister of Fuel, who without preliminary warning or skirmishing suddenly got up in the House of Commons last Friday afternoon and announced that petrol, gasoline to you, would come off the ration forthwith. The minister then dramatically tore up his own book of petrol coupons, having first and wisely taken the precaution of ensuring that the press photographers were on hand to record this act of liberation. Sensation, screamed the newsboys. Sound socialist plannings, said the socialists somewhat smugly. Vote catching, muttered the conservatives, at the same time happily filling up their tanks. Petrol has been rationed in this country for 10 years. For 10 years, motorists have been allocated a basic allowance so small as to make it in most cases uneconomical to keep a car on the road. In my own case, enough to do exactly 180 miles a month in the summer, or in the winter, when the face value of the petrol coupons had a nasty habit of being halved, 90 miles a month. In other words, you could have driven from Newark to New Haven, and that was the extent of your month's motoring. You could and did apply for extra coupons for essential travel, or for what you consider to be essential travel, but unless you had a mighty sound reason for getting additional gas, these supplementary coupons were bestowed about as generously as the Victoria Cross by the fuel officers, now happily unemployed or seeking other channels in which to direct their suspicious and miserly natures. As a result, as always happens with any form of prohibition or control, the unscrupulous resorted to the fiddle. But now, with the fuel officers and the coupon books, the petrol black marketeers have gone. And for the first time in 10 years, we know the joy of stopping at a pump and saying, fill her up. By accident or design, the rationing ceased just before the Whitsun holiday, and as a result, everyone who has ever driven a car, and from their behavior, a great many people who had never driven a car in their lives, everyone was out on the far-from-open road this last weekend. The seaside boarding houses and the country hotels breathed again, for they'd been very hard hit by this petrol rationing. Traffic jams and deaths on the road got back to pre-war proportions. The price of second-hand automobiles rocketed. Week by week, you see, we who fought for freedom are becoming almost indecently unfettered. You can now pay what you like for a meal in a restaurant. You can buy a gallon of petrol for 3 shillings. Rabbits are to be decontrolled as from midnight tonight. And there is a rumor that before long, we may be able to buy a bar of soap when we are dirty and not when the government tells us. Meantime, hail to thee, blithe spirit. And if you would like to hear the sound of a book of British petrol coupons being torn in half, here it is. Goodbye.
And it's goodbye too from this edition of London Column, a radio digest produced by Stephen Eckard, presented by Peter Watson, and which came to you in the North American service of the BBC.
That was London Column, a transcribed program. This is the British Broadcasting Corporation.